You know, the advantages are compelling, right? Virtually unlimited energy, virtually unlimited cooling. What's not to love? And if they can make the tech work, awesome. And then, of course, I came down and thought, the maintenance of this sounds just like an absolute nightmare.
All that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to the Halloween episode of Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together a panel of brilliant, funny, and somewhat spooky panelists to distill down what's important in the latest news in artificial intelligence. Joining us today are three incredible panelists, so a very warm welcome to Gabe Goodhart, who is Chief Architect, AI Open Innovation, Chris Hay, who is a distinguished engineer, and Kate Soul, who is Director of Technical Product Management for Granite. Lots of topics today. We're going to talk a little bit about Anthropic's commitment to TPUs, a little bit about AI insurance, some interesting blog posts out of OpenAI on sensitive conversations, and finally, data centers in space. But first, we've got Eileen with the news.
Hey, everyone. I'm Eileen McConnon, a tech news writer for IBM Think. I'm here with a few AI headlines you might have missed this week. OpenAI has restructured, becoming a more traditional for-profit company. This move gives Microsoft a whopping $135 billion share in OpenAI. NVIDIA has become the first company to reach a $5 trillion market valuation, powered by its chip business. To put this in perspective, NVIDIA is now worth about twice as much as JPMorgan Chase, Walmart, ExxonMobil, and Johnson & Johnson combined. Amazon has unveiled AI-powered smart glasses for delivery drivers. The glasses guide the drivers as they walk with directions and alerts to identify any hazards along their way, all so they don't need to look down to check their phones. Halloween can be scary, especially for your dog. A Toronto-based digital agency has created a playlist that combines AI and canine sound science to help dogs stay calm through the Halloween noise and excitement. Want to dive deeper into some of these topics? Subscribe to the Think newsletter, linked in the show notes. Now back to the episode.
First, I really want to start with another kind of massive blog post from Anthropic that came out this week. I'll just quote it, but it basically is their announcement that they're going to be increasing their work with Google Cloud and specifically their sort of Google's TPU kind of AI chip. So they say, quote, "Today, we are announcing that we plan to expand our use of Google Cloud technologies, including up to 1 million TPUs, dramatically increasing our compute resources as we continue to push the boundaries of AI research and product development. The expansion is worth tens of billions of dollars and is expected to bring well over a gigawatt of capacity online in 2026, so like 12 months from now, basically. So this is another blog post where, you know, every day, like, there's another post where you're like, the numbers are just mind-boggling. Chris, do you want to give an intuition for, like, why is Anthropic going big with TPUs after, I guess, happily working with NVIDIA and also Amazon as well for years at this point?
I think they just want to push NVIDIA's net worth down from $5 trillion to $4.99 trillion. I think
just knock a few little digits out of there. So.
That's their motivation. Now, I think it actually makes a lot of sense, right? Which is, the reality is that they are on multiple clouds. They're on AWS. They are on Google, et cetera. And if you think about the GPU, you know, how hard it is to get GPUs these days, actually being able to just sort of diversify your stock a little bit there, I think is a really smart strategy. And therefore, you can get the best costs for inference. You can run across multiple clouds. You can use Google infrastructure. So I think it's a very, very smart strategy. Now, technically, I think it makes things harder because you're not depending, you know, you're not being able to take advantage of things like the CUDA performance improvements, and you need to go and find these things and run different architectures to support these chips. So they're making life difficult for themselves, but I totally understand why diversifying is a good thing.
Yeah, and okay, I kind of was interested in, like, I mean, my instinct is like operating in each one of these chip platforms is kind of its own beast. And so almost like what Anthropic is saying is, like, we need chips so much that we're willing to, like, deal with all of that operational complexity. Is that the right way of thinking about it? Like, it's like a lot less complicated than it used to be in terms of moving across platforms?
I think it certainly probably is less complicated than it was 2 years ago. But I think what it also is reflecting is the compute needs are continuing to shift from what used to be very training heavy workloads for these providers to inference heavy workloads for these providers, where it's a lot easier to get your model to run on these other chips than it is to train on these other chips. And so from that perspective, it makes a lot of sense as Anthropic's looking to scale their deployments and is using reasoning models and other kind of what we call test time compute approaches that continue to boost up their inference costs to find newer, cheaper ways to scale that inferencing. My guess is that they're still going to use NVIDIA to train.
Okay. Why is that?
For some of the same reasons Chris stated with CUDA and all of the like optimizations that they've undoubtedly sunk into their NVIDIA-based stack.
Yeah, it's almost like they've invested already. So why would you start from kind of like start again in some ways?
Yeah, and I think that's just like NVIDIA's cash cow. Like that's what they've really optimized for some of these like most advanced GPUs they're building and where they really have a differentiated edge compared to TPUs and Trainium and other chips.
Yeah, I did want to talk about that, Gabe, a little bit, because my understanding is, I mean, the move to a TPU is distinct, right? It's actually not a GPU. And, you know, my understanding is it's an ASIC, right? It's sort of like a chip that's kind of designed specifically for AI applications. And I think for a long time, people have been like, oh, well, you know, the GPU is kind of like a historical accident. And we're eventually going to move to the world of like a true AI chip from first principles, basically. And so I don't know if this is like, I mean, they're 1 million TPUs is a lot of TPUs. It feels like maybe we're kind of finally crossing that threshold into like a world of more, much more specialized chips. But I don't know. I'm curious about what you think about that.
Yeah. I mean, just to pick on the point about CUDA and sort of the incumbency there, there's both the incumbency at the hardware level, but actually where it's really sticky is at the all of the kernels that their engineers have spent hours, days, months, weeks, years tuning to be perfectly aligned with that hardware. And my guess is that what they're going to do is put all of their older models on the TPUs where the non-CUDA code ecosystem has caught up on the kernel implementations. And they're going to keep driving the novel architectures, because basically each one of these models is just a collection of tensor ops, but each one of those has to be carefully tuned for the stride and the batching and the SIMD chunking of how you actually run this giant pile of math. And at the end of the day, it's a bunch of adds, subtracts, mutates, bit shifts, and
at the end
all
of the, like that complicated.
The low level gorpy crap that you know, like you can't read because it doesn't make any sense until you finally like ingest your head into that parallel view of a grid. But they're going to keep innovating in NVIDIA to get the latest and greatest, whatever. If they're implementing some novel architecture, it's almost certainly going to be CUDA first. But at this point, many of the other driver packages like Vulkan, and maybe to a lesser degree, OpenCL and others are starting to catch up on performance for some of these well-understood tensor ops. And you've probably got most of your less innovative model architectures poised and ready to go to just run on any old platform you can because it's reached parity across the different, you know, software driver layers. So I think that's really smart in that sense, if they can offload the sort of well-trodden path to cheaper, more efficient hardware and keep the expensive hardware for the cutting edge, that's going to give them a nice sort of twofold advantage. And nowadays, I mean, I think originally all of these tensor ops that were powering these novel architectures were new. And so the platforms hadn't caught up across the board. But now that, you know, we're a few years or, you know, AI decades into this space.
AI centuries, basically.
exactly. You know, it's really started to level out a bit. And we'll probably see that in general across alternate hardware, that NVIDIA leads the way on the novel architectures and alternate hardware sort of picks up the broad breadth for efficiency plays.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's one thing that occurs to me. And Chris, yeah, I was actually about to just kind of turn to you. I mean, you had a joke at the very beginning where they're like, maybe we'll just like knock some hundreds of millions of dollars off of like NVIDIA's market cap. And I think we often talk in terms of like, oh, who's going to take on NVIDIA? But this is almost like there's like kind of room for everybody, it sort of seems like here, where like basically there's like a role for NVIDIA to play. But like, I mean, that capacity that you need to just do inference on well-understood models is huge. And so it's a kind of like maybe a world where like in the future, it really won't you know, like it will basically be like all the major model providers kind of are doing what Anthropic is doing here. Do you agree with that?
I agree. And let's face it, Anthropic needs that capacity. Anyone who's ever tried to use the Claude model at midnight UK time will understand that the API limits, capacity limits, reach, come back later. You know, if they're going to get a million TPUs, I'm fine with that. Just just don't deprive me of my precious Claude model.
It's a move
that
for
I
you
need to
specifically.
Exactly. So go for it, Anthropic. And so I think it is necessary, and I think that diversification is good. So I'm happy with that. I'm not surprised though. I mean, I think I've said this before, but I'll say it again. Like, it's like the following trend of Bitcoin is just hilarious, right? You know, Bitcoin started with CPUs, then they went to GPUs, and then they went to FPGAs, and then they went to ASICs. And guess what? You know, AI is following the exact same. And it makes sense, right? Which is, if you've got custom models that are always doing roughly the same thing, and you can get faster, less general specific chips that do that job cheaper, then go for it. So, and we've already seen that play out very well. If you look at like the Grok chips, for example, then they run incredibly fast. So I'm all for it. Just so I can play with Claude at midnight. That's all
like,
I need.
Please let Claude be accessible. That's really what I want. Maybe kind of a final question here, Kate. So we've kind of, in the context that this has come up in for OpenAI, we've talked a lot about them ultimately going like kind of more vertically integrated, right? There's a lot of rumors about the OpenAI chip and what are they doing with the OpenAI chip and what it will look like and all that sort of stuff. We're seeing that, I think, at least to my recollection, unless you've heard otherwise, like Anthropic seems to be doing that less, to say like, oh, we need an Anthropic chip and we're going to really hype an Anthropic chip. But I think both are kind of peer competitors in a certain way. Do you think there's a reason why Anthropic is like not really getting into the hardware game?
I think Anthropic's position has been far more focused on like meeting practical enterprise deployment needs, where OpenAI is obviously on the pursuit of super general intelligence at all costs. And so I think from OpenAI's perspective, they might be playing a bit of a longer game and looking at to get to truly, you know, differentiated AGI style intelligence. Are there maybe even co-optimizations that need to be made between models and chips all the way down the stack? And, you know, how does that kind of unfold more broadly? And, you know, I am not an AGI believer person. So I very much more resonate towards Anthropic's approach, which is, regardless of AGI, what are the practical use cases that can be solved today with AI, and how do I scale up my demand to meet it? So I think they're really like,
and solve it.
Yeah, it gets to very philosophical differences of like how
for
these
sure.
companies are pursuing innovation.
Well, that AI skepticism is good for, I think, what will be our next topic that I want to move us on to. So I think it's become almost like a little bit of a joke, which is like when you want something passed around and discussed in AI land, you launch a freestanding website that just has your essay on it. And this past week was no exception. So this essay, I think that came out, I think maybe a few weeks ago, called Underwriting Superintelligence, from a number of researchers and then a guy who runs a company, this guy, Rune, who runs a company on insuring kind of AI platforms. And the subject of the essay of Underwriting Superintelligence is really about kind of like the role of insurance in allowing new technologies to form. And one of the things they focus on is what they call the incentive flywheel. Basically, the idea is like once you have people insuring a new technology or a new space, they tend to want to lower the risks and they tend to want like the people that they're insuring to do a good job managing the risk. And they kind of describe this sort of virtuous cycle whereby, you know, the insurance company says you need to adopt certain standards. Those standards make it possible to do audits. And then those audits simultaneously like make like things safer and help price that insurance. And so I thought this was kind of a fun idea. It's very much couched in the world of like, well, we're about to head into AGI world. But I think this is a kind of like bigger kind of interesting question about like insurance in the AI space. And I guess, you know, Gabe, I kind of wanted to actually kick it to you first because you do a lot of work in sort of like, you know, open innovation, open models. You know, I guess the question of kind of like the risk to the open model provider, is that something that you guys like talk about in your space at all? Like I'm about to launch a new open source model. Do I have to be worried as the provider of that model of like the liability should something go wrong with it going forwards? Curious if that's like in your world at all.
Yeah, I would say it really depends on how an open model is being positioned. I think there are plenty of organizations that are just out there trying to make something cool that people play with and find some value in. I would say from our position in IBM, I don't want to put words in your mouth, Kate, but I'd say we actually do care quite a lot about this. You know, Kate, I'll let you talk about the certification for Granite 4, but there already are sort of baby steps in this direction around guaranteeing and adding verifiable tracing through the training process to ensure that the models are in fact meeting benchmarks for you know, best practices in training and security. So one of the things that really struck me about this article was that, you know, this is already happening a little bit piecemeal, but I think the overall sort of framing of this as an insurance problem that follows other sort of risk-sensitive markets and ecosystems like vehicles and fire and building and just sort of infrastructure components was an interesting take on it. You know, the science part of me always gets skeptical when these things talk about, oh, just throw evals at the problem and everything gets solved, because evals at the problem is, you know, an undefined set of words. However, then, you know, I think about if I were an automotive engineer and, you know, I'd probably have exactly the same skepticism about various different safety standards. I used to work in defense and there were all kinds of hoops you had to jump through. And the old joke was like, just don't try to apply logic to security. Just check the boxes, right? And it's really frustrating as an engineer. However, this sort of dumbing down of the complexity space is almost required in order to make that complexity space manageable for folks outside of the deepest sort of knowledge bases of that complexity space. So whether it's AI, you know, defense systems, cars, probably even, you know, fire prevention, there's probably a ton of nuance that I have no idea how it works. And I just look for, you know, fire safety certifications before buying, you know, a bed for my child kind of thing. So there's some really interesting points in this article. I think, you know, the part that struck me as the most challenging is, you know, getting the flywheel off the ground, so to speak. And obviously, this is a little bit motivated by the author's vested interest in trying to be the insurance company for this marketplace. But I think the key here is for consumers to put their money where the certifications lie, right? It has to basically start with where the money flows. That's what gets the flywheel turning. And, you know, no one's going to pay for insurance for their model if it doesn't actually boost their bottom line and get more consumers to use their model. So I think it'll be really interesting to see, and that sort of gets back to that, how do we dumb down the complexity space enough that it becomes actually meaningful to consumers to say, I'm going to pick this model, whether it's open or closed, because it's got this certification and I know I can trust it, or because it's indemnified in this way. And I know if it does something terrible, I actually have somebody I can sue and get, you know, recourse for out of the model provider.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of the question that I felt was like maybe one of the things lurking behind. And maybe Kate, I'll throw it to you because it sounds like, you know, you guys are already working on some things that are shaped a little bit like this, but like kind of, it feels like before you get to insurance, people are going to just be like, can you certify to certain things, right? Like, can you guarantee certain things, you know, regardless of whether or not you're going to like pay me if something goes wrong. And so I guess there's a world where this evolves where you might not ever need kind of third-party insurance potentially, at least in like most cases, because most people are just being like, yeah, do you meet certain standards? Okay, if you've met certain standards, then I'm happy to adopt this, right? And then it kind of like, Gabe, to your point, like the businesses are happy because they're getting more business as a result. But I guess, Kate, it sounds like maybe you all at Granite are kind of thinking about some of this stuff in piecemeal.
I think understanding and mitigating risk has certainly been at the core of our strategy with Granite from the beginning. So, for example, we made a lot of decisions very early on to make sure and take preventative measures to prohibit, you know, known pirated content, for example, that has been the subject of many lawsuits in the U.S. from being used in training. We're very open and transparent about the data that we're using, which is really just a testament to how careful we're being about data selection. And, you know, I think that has ultimately led to us continuing to work with different standards bodies to get certification for that steps to help educate our customers and users on the variety that exists in model development and why aspects are important. So Granite is the first open source model family that was developed according to ISO 42001 standards, which is really exciting. The only other model developer, there's plenty of model providers, but the only other model developer I'm aware of with those standards is Anthropic's Claude. So not many providers have gone after that certification, but I think it is starting to grow in terms of its prevalence in the at least US-based markets. I struggle, though, with how insurance kind of plays a role. I think there's a couple of different things going on. So one, like there are examples, and the article even cites it, of insurance for example, for copyright protection. So Copilot came out first saying that, you know, we'll insure and indemnify, real identification, indemnify against, you know, if the model produces copyrighted output and you use that in your products, we'll protect you. I worry that there will be the best providers to understand the true risks won't be the insurance companies, it'll be the model developers themselves, just because this technology is so new. They had somewhere in the article citing that there's only like 100 researchers who are qualified to do model audits in the United States. Like, there are very few people who like understand the technology to the detailed level needed to assess that risk, as well as very few companies open and transparent enough and, you know, kind of governing the development in a way that that risk can be well tracked and understood. So I don't see a great opportunity for third-party insurance providers to come in and kind of buffer against that risk.
It'll be like first-party insurance, basically. Yeah, it's kind of like, well, you're going to use our model, and if you get into trouble, it'll be like the copyright thing.
IBM does that as well, right? So we provide indemnification for our models when they're used, Granite models when they're used through Watsonx product lines, because we understand better than anyone else could, you know, the extent to how these models were trained and the risks that they can create. So I think that's going to, you know, potentially prevent third-party insurance providers coming in. I also, you know, had some questions that this article raised. You know, it does discuss the importance of moving fast and being competitive against China. But, you know, insurance by definition is really not a global market. Like insurance, you always have like a population that is, you know, similar in some characteristics that pool their risks together and provide protection. And so, like, if all of these Chinese model providers and developers don't have this kind of standards and or insurance policies, they're going to keep moving probably with less regulation than US-based ones. They're going to move a lot faster, and that's just going to disincentivize US companies from operating under the same constraints in order to stay competitive. And I didn't think the article had a really great solution to that. You know, I don't see that going away, and I don't think insurance is going to like allow us to compete more competitively in that sense. So, you know, it raised for me more questions than I think it answered ultimately.
One thing, I guess, Chris, I'll bring you into this conversation, because I think in previous MOEs, you've tended to be our most like, not that you're like a super intelligence believer, but you tend to be kind of the most bullish on capacities getting really, really, you know, fantastical, I guess, so, you know, in the near term. Do you believe a little bit more in that? Because it feels like your calculations kind of change if you believe that, like, oh yeah, we're about to see these AIs do like incredible things with that are very high risk that maybe, you know, like the first party model providers are not going to be able to like self-insure, essentially. And so like maybe there's kind of pressure, like if your model is going to be used for some crazy, you know, DNA printing thing that has like a huge bio risk, you might eventually want to kind of like outsource that to like a third party insurance market. Were you a little bit more sympathetic to this article, or were you kind of similarly skeptical like Kate and Gabe?
Insurance leads to clauses. Clauses lead to gray areas. Gray areas lead to lawyers, and lawyers lead to the dark side. That's my opinion on this one. So I am not a fan of this. The world does not need more lawyers.
Because of the lawyers, basically.
No, I don't want this. And you say, you know, the model providers who are the model providers? They are all billion, trillion dollar companies. If a trillion dollar company can't afford to insure, right? Some of the richest companies in the world can't afford to insure their models. Who do they think are going to insure these models? It's like, what planet are we living on? And to your point, Kate and Gabe, right, which is, do you think suddenly OpenAI, Anthropic are going to go, please come in, I want to show you the inner details of my model. Please, 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 please. And then you can write it up in your insurance, etc. No, and we know what the clauses are going to be like. Ah, you must do this in a safe and secure way. You must not prompt inject. You must not do this. And it is always going to come back to being your fault of why the model went wrong. It's never going to be my fault. You'll be like, oh, you didn't put a safety rail in there. I don't know. Was I meant to do that? You know, it's like, you never told me. You know, it's always going to be my fault. And what am I going to be doing? I'm going to be handing them over money. And then contact centers are going to ring me up. It's like, do you want me to insure your ChatGPT instance? You know, that's going to be $300 a month, grandma. You know, and I'm going to be like, no, this is not an industry I want. Insurance is bad.
Okay.
Yeah. I think there's one other thing. This article gets wrong or misses the point on entirely, which is so much of AI-based risk is use case specific. So having, you know, insurance policy for general model deployments and for general models themselves, like, is, I think, just very naive. If you're talking about, okay, here's a very specific biomedical application where we need X, Y, and Z regulations to ensure consumer safety and health, that has existed forever. Not forever. That has existed for a while now and is really important and should continue to exist and expand to, you know, consider these new AI-based ones. But these kind of like global policies, which again is really based off of the entire premise of this article, is we're going to have, you know, artificial general intelligence and super intelligence. And so therefore we need super intelligence insurance, I think is really just not practical or realistic of what the real risks are and what needs to be solved for in the near term.
Well, and Kate, to your point, you know, I think there's a lot of debate about what super intelligence actually means. You could achieve super intelligence in a specific domain vertical where the machine can do better than top individuals trying to solve that problem. That might be a great, very specific slice of a market for an insurance policy. However, sort of the AI, stop at those two letters, insure that thing. I agree. It's really wide open, and you're going to basically just get back around to let's trust the model creators because they're the ones that actually understand these problems, that they've done it correctly. So it's a chain of trust without a root certificate, right?
And to that point, Gabe, it's lazy offloading, right? Because to your earlier point, it's like, okay, you're providing a product and service, and that service has got to be compliant with whatever regulation. Does it do the thing? That is your responsibility as the product to decide whether the AI is suitable and you've tested it enough to be in your product. By insuring the model, you're just offloading your risk, which I guess people want to do, and it's lazy. You know what I mean? It's lazy. So I get why you want to do it. And if the model developers want to insure that risk, that's fine. And I can imagine that many do for various reasons. But I assure you, when it goes wrong and you're looking at your credits for that month and go, oh, I got my credits back for that month because it went wrong, I don't think that's going to cover your risk. So that's kind of my issue on that.
All right. MOE, skeptical of superintelligence and just hates lawyers.
So. I'm not skeptical of superintelligence. I'm still right on for
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you're skeptical of insurance.
I just don't like insurance or lawyers.
All right, noted. Well, I'm going to move us on to our next topic, which actually I think I wanted to put these two next to one another because I think they sort of rhyme in interesting ways. So we just talked a little bit about, you know, I think an essay that was like very speculative about like superintelligence and how you might insure against those risks. And in some ways, like the next topic that we're going to talk about is also about companies managing their risk, but in like a very, very different context. And I thought it was kind of like a fun to kind of put them next to one another. OpenAI did a blog post talking a little bit about how they're working to make sure that ChatGPT can navigate sensitive conversations with people well and safely. And it's a really super interesting post that kind of goes through sort of like their philosophy of how they attack these problems, some of the data that they've seen from GPT-5, and overall kind of like how they're sort of managing this from a product standpoint. And you know, to our conversation earlier, I think it's like a good example of maybe an alternative path about how companies will manage some of the risk here, which is, I think what OpenAI is doing here is just sort of showing the work. They say, okay, you're worried about this. Here's the evaluations we've done. Here's how we think about it. and you have to make your decision on whether or not you want to use this product. And I think, you know, Kay, maybe I can kick it over to you. I think the first sort of really interesting problem is just from a product standpoint, it's really hard to do safety in this space because the number of actual real-world cases is so rare. So they point out that basically, you know, they say across these kind of sensitive conversations, and there's a question about how you define that, they say their initial analysis estimates only about 0.07% of users active in a given week and 0.01% of messages indicate possible signs of mental health emergencies related to psychosis or mania. And that's kind of an interesting problem, right? Because I think like the usual machine learning thing is like, well, like, can we collect some cases and fine tune against that? But here you're kind of like, it's very, very limited. I guess mostly I'm just sort of interested in sort of your take on like, if you like kind of buy their approach on how they're managing this, which is we only have a few examples. So we're going to rely on panels of experts. We're going to rely on like simulated kind of evals. Like, is this the way that you think kind of like is going to become sort of the industry method for kind of attacking these types of problems?
I mean, I like read these articles and then in the back of my head, I'm like, didn't Sam Altman just say, we're going to let it treat adults like adults and let erotica on our platform and like get rid of guardrails and safety altogether?
I was going to ask about that as well. So if you want to take that question also, like what's going on here with the split screen?
Seems, very discordant at least. But look, I think they are certainly, it's good that they're engaging and they're being more open about work that they're taking with these kind of like taxonomy-based approaches, which are very similar to ones that we use at IBM, to map out and define safety issues, particularly around mental health, and that they're engaging with like subject matter experts and clinicians in the area to figure out best ways to respond. That doesn't mean, though, that they're like, I don't know that they still have the right incentives to fully solve this problem. And, you know, you'll notice a lot of things about what they say are very vague. So 0.01%, first of all, can still be an amazing amount of data on potentially suspect mental health conversations if we're talking about like ChatGPT usage. And they talk a lot about, oh, we've had, you know, a 65% reduction in harmful responses, but they don't tell you the percentage of harmful responses they started out with. So is this a 65% reduction where 50% of the time the model was saying something awful, or 1% of the time the model was saying something awful and now it's down to, you know, 0.35? So I think there's still being, I think the lawyers got in there, Chris, and definitely heavily post-edited that release to try and make this like, okay, we're going to be open, we're going to start talking about it, but we're not going to tell you too much.
Is it right to say you're kind of skeptical?
Like, I'm skeptical,
this show,
yeah.
This maybe like seems to indicate more than it actually does. Yeah.
It's not necessarily a bad thing, but I am certainly skeptical that they're doing the full extent that they can to solve the problem or have the incentives to solve it. And to really take this as seriously as it needs to be taken. I also worry that, you know, you called this very much like a product-based strategy. And so at the product level, they could be doing a lot of work that then doesn't get addressed at the lower level, like endpoints that the rest of the world is building their own products off of. And so how that translates to, you know, to where we're now having advertisements being sold to consumers who are, you know, having mental health issues and breaks and problems, and like how that translates to other broader applications, I think is concerning and not really addressed. So, you know, I think there's just a lot more work to be done ultimately.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of comes back to the chain of trust question, right? If you as a consumer have decided that OpenAI is a company you trust, this is a great article. It's like, man, look at all this great stuff. I'm leaning into trusting that they are, you know, really trying to do their best, right? They've got a lot of verbiage about working hard and doing their best. And that's great. If you are not already founded on a root of trust in OpenAI, there's a whole lot of holes to poke in this article, right? There's lots left to your imagination to fill in. Exactly as Kate said, you know, what does an actual positive or negative outcome mean here, right? It's a really gray space. And, you know, to the previous conversation, it's really hard to establish trust here. This is, you know, the realm of non-Gaussian statistics, right? We're off in the tail end of the distribution. And it's hard. It's hard math. It's hard science. So, you know, I fall probably somewhere in the middle of the trust spectrum. I think the fact that they're putting this out there means at least some real work was probably done and is probably making some positive improvements. But juxtaposed against the public messaging, it's still really hard to know, you know, exactly where this falls and how much this is a sort of cover your sorry, CYA blog post versus
sorry, we'll catch it in post.
yeah, exactly. Versus a, you know, a real sign of technical improvements. And we also know that any company of reasonable size, the left hand doesn't really talk to the right hand very well, especially if the right hand is a public figure at the top of the company. And so it's very possible that there are chunks within the OpenAI organization who really truly are trying to fight the good fight and do the right thing here. And that is then running into the buzzsaw of product decision making and public messaging and all of that, that makes it hard to get the science in the right place. So it's probably a much more complicated picture behind the curtain than this blog post is presenting. I'm glad that they're at least putting a foot forward, but I'm still, you know, very guarded in my trust of them as an organization and any organization, frankly, that's self-certifying that it's doing the right thing.
For sure. And I think this is like, Aaron, kind of the problem, right? Which is like, I think on the last conversation we said, well, the more realistic outcome is that these companies are going to self-certify. I think now we're at a case where like, we're talking self-certification and we're like, yeah, is this the kind of certification we really want? Is like kind of where like there's, you're kind of stuck between two maybe not so great scenarios. I guess, Chris, I think one of the things that really struck me about this piece outside of the data was it's also OpenAI starting to show like how their point of view on how these types of technologies should respond in certain types of situations. So the example I'm thinking a little bit about is they said, well, okay, in cases where we detect that the user is becoming emotionally reliant on the model, then our intervention is that the model should tell them to have more real-world conversations. Which is like a very like a specific kind of like opinion about like what the model should be doing in that context. And I guess you can just kind of take that case. I was kind of curious if like you think that is actually the desired behavior for these technologies. Like if they detect you are becoming emotionally reliable or emotionally reliant, you know, that they should say like, hey, have you considered like talking to other people in the real world? Is that like effective from your point of view? Do you think that this is like a good way for these models to kind of approach, you know, these situations?
I am the last person you should be asking these questions, Tim, I think.
As someone who is very emotionally reliant on Claude.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I think it's difficult, right? I think, first of all, I mean, to Kate's point, 800 million users at 0.07% of the, you know, that's a huge number. Do you know what I mean? That's a frightening number. I think people who are relying on AI, and I don't really know in that sense I rely on Claude, but not for emotional stuff. But I mean, I think the reality is maybe they're in a scenario where going and speaking to a human isn't an option. Do you know what I mean? And maybe they're relying on the AI for those very reasons, because it's a very difficult subject and going to speak to a human about that is going to be difficult for them. So I understand the sort of things that they're doing there. And I think people need help wherever they need help, whether it comes from an AI, whether it comes from another human. And, you know, and I think the good thing they're doing is they're speaking to professionals who are telling them what the right things to say. So I think I applaud all of that. I guess the skeptic in me is just like, I hope that they really want people to get the right help that they need. And it's not off setting the blame and say, well, you know, they contacted us and we said go speak to a human being and they didn't do that, and again those pesky lawyers are back again. So I don't know, but I don't think there's a good answer in these scenarios. And I hate to say, I think it's going to get worse, right? Because at the moment, we're chatting with ChatGPT and others as a text mode. Of course, we have the voice mode, especially when you're driving and things like that. But as more modalities come, more and more, you've got the more realistic-looking avatars, et cetera, and those technologies progress, it's going to start to feel more human-like. And I think these problems are going to push more and more. So I don't know what the answer is, but I do applaud them for trying, I think.
Yeah, and on the applaud them for trying, there's actually, it was a corollary piece I think it launched yesterday, maybe the day before. They just actually published previews of fine-tuned versions of their open weights models that are designed around policy enforcement. So very similar to the Granite Guardian series, where the user provides an actual policy that they want to check whether the input or output adheres to, and then it'll do sort of real-time on-the-fly evaluation against that policy. So I thought that was maybe the most interesting part. I suspect that the timing is not coincidental, although it may be. But if they're actually making a real stride towards putting solutions to some of these problems out in the open, I think that's actually really encouraging. So I'm very curious to check those out. One thing I noticed that was slightly different than how we framed the Guardian models is that our Guardian models are specifically tuned towards a collection of policies that we have data for, whereas it sounds like what they've built is a general purpose policy evaluation model that could take an arbitrary policy delineated by a user and evaluate against that. I know that
Granite does have arbitrary policy evaluations.
Okay.
Just saying.
Thank you, Kate. I'm sorry, I misrepresented. Yes, I misrepresented. All right. So arbitrary policy is well in the Guardian series, and they're smaller, and we should try those first. Yeah, the point being, putting this together as a system is an actual good technical step forward that others can, put their hands on and feel and build some of their own trust in the technology versus just reading the blog post. So I think that's an encouraging sign that there's some real tech being released in the open to put some weight behind these assertions.
To me, it really feels almost like a fundamental philosophical question. Should AI be used for companionship? And, I think to Chris's point, there are real scenarios where AI as a companion can provide benefits. But the way, if that's the case, if we want to be able to enable that, it feels like that should be the primary objective in having healthy relationships with technology and AI companionships that provide value, and needs to be a lot more core and fundamental in how these models and chatbots are being built. I worry that, OpenAI's approach so far, it's great. Like I said, they're doing better things, and it's great that they're talking about it publicly. But, it includes stuff like, I noticed in their article that they route to a safe model if you're in distress. And if not, then you get to use the, treat adults like adults model, presumably, without guardrails and everything else. And so I do think it comes a bit philosophical of like, how ingrained should these guardrails and safety protocols be? And are you designing for like safe companionship up front, or is this being tacked on at the end and like, someone so-and-so has some red flags, we're gonna put them down the, safety mode, bumper rails, like in a padded room so that they don't hurt themselves, so to speak. Which I think just feels a little bit unsafe ultimately, but isn't how I would want a AI companionship that my loved ones are talking to if they need support or help.
All right, I'm going to move us on to our last topic, just kind of a fun story that kind of popped up. So NVIDIA did a blog post about a company that they're supporting called StarCloud. And the premise of StarCloud is data centers in space. And the CEO has this incredible quote, which is, in 10 years, nearly all the new data centers will be built in outer space. And so let me just kind of like lay out the sort of argument, the pitch of StarCloud, and then we'd love to kind of get everybody's sort of takes on it. The idea is, in space, you have a lot of benefits. One of them is cooling, right? You don't need to use a lot of water because you're in the vacuum of space. And the second one is energy, right? Like you can also like generate a lot of effectively green energy through solar. When I heard this concept, I was like, this is a little wild of an idea. And I guess maybe Gabe, I'll kick it over to you first. Like, are data centers headed to space? Like, we're doing all of this terrestrial construction on data centers. Is this a model where maybe these advantages actually do encourage us to like put stuff up in the sky?
So I went on a little roller coaster ride while I was reading this article. The first thing I thought was like, this is absurd. I read the title. And then we got into the meat and potatoes of it, and sort of, I think the advantages are legitimate. Like these
so
are
your
two,
believer. Okay, cool.
The,
nice.
Well, I'm not at the end of my roller coaster ride. the advantages are compelling, right? Virtually unlimited energy, virtually unlimited cooling. What's not to love? And if they can make the tech work, awesome. And then, of course, I came down and thought, Shoot, NVIDIA just launched a brand new card. I guess I better scrap that one and start a whole new data center? Or shoot, one of the devices is failing. I need to send somebody over to the rack to pull one out and put... Ah, damn it, I can't do that. So the maintenance of this sounds just like an absolute nightmare. And one of the one of the projects I was adjacent to in my previous gig in defense was actually around space object tracking, which is really, really hard. It turns out there are a... metric something load of things floating around out there that are just taking up space, trajectory orbiting the Earth, and are really, really hard to track. And there's always the possibility that they crash into something or fall to the ground and cause major damage. So space is not just like a happy little bubble up there that you can just toss stuff into. It's a really, it's already a very, very crowded physical space that has real implications. So putting a technology that is obsoleted on a six-month basis into space, that's to me where I see the problem. You know, the benefits are clear. That's great if we can actually realize that. But how in the world are you going to keep up with the pace of innovation in the physical hardware that you're sticking up there? I have no idea how that would be feasible.
Yeah, I love the idea that like you got to replace the cards. So we're going to just ship a guy up there to kind of float around like, and replace the cards. So.
I mean, it'd make for a real cool movie.
Part of me is like, wow, that is just so cool.
Yeah, I think it would be cool.
It would just be so cool.
Super jazz reading it, yeah.
But I do wonder about things like, you know, I like on the side, somewhat interested in astronomy and like space clutter. And like, it is a real thing, the debris fields that are growing. And there is, I think it's going to be really fascinating to see how some of the like regulatory environments grow up around that. And particularly like geopolitical control over space obviously is all very immature right now and something that will be critical if all of our now infrastructure is all of a sudden dependent, critical infrastructure is dependent on this like uncharted territory. So, you know, I think there's a lot of, I think it's more going to be like the political difficulties that will prevent this or potentially delay this from becoming more of a reality than maybe even the physical or practical. But, you know, at the end of the day, there's part of me that's just like geeking out a little bit about it. Like, yeah, that sounds awesome. It's just cool.
Chris, you've got the last word for this episode.
I'm looking forward to the Mark Rober video where he attaches a GPU to a balloon and sends it up to space and he beats everybody to the punch. That's what I'm looking forward to. I mean, Gabe and Kay covered it all. I think it's a stupid idea. Go work on making GPUs smaller and better and, you know, and have the model smaller so we can enjoy them here without much power usage. Don't make it space the problem as well.
This is a great episode. Everybody was so spicy today. But that's all the time that we have for today. So Kate, Chris, Gabe, great to have you on the show as always. And thanks to all you listeners. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we'll see you next week on Mixture of Experts.
Boo.
Boo. Although booing like that makes me feel as if I'm watching the New York Giants at the moment and I'm just so booing.